My name is Patrick, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Ashley will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Ashley. I'm an alcoholic. AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Colin will read the steps.
Hello, my name is Colin, and I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Meredith will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Meredith. I'm an alcoholic. The traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purposes, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscious. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Kevin.
Surprise me. Hi, my name's Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. Well, I was a little surprised. I thought she was going to go first, but I'm ready. All right, my name is Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. My sober date is New Year's Eve, 2003, and I'm a member of the Atlantic Group. I basically really love this group because one of the reasons is because they follow the traditions, and the fifth tradition is each group has but one primary purpose: carry the message of alcoholics who still suffer. And you can find it easier here than you can find it anywhere else, in my eyes, from my experience. All right, I got 10 minutes, so I got to get busy. All right. Well, near my first recognition, I was 8 years old. I grew up in a nice suburban family in Floral Park, nice house, a few siblings, a brother and two sisters, and everything was pretty nice. And one day in my life, my father came home in a state of rage. He kicked in the TV and left. My mother had a nervous breakdown. I wound up in like a semi-foster care with relatives. And they lost the house. And I'm saying that is because a resentment was built that almost took me to the gates of death. What happened was that I wound up with a nice uncle in Huntington for about 3 or 4 years. About 10 or 11 or 12, I was shipped to an alcoholic family in Queens Village, New York. And verbal abuse, physical abuse was rampant. And one night they were both alcoholic, and my first drink was at a Christmas party. There was drinks all around, and a lot of people use the term, I had arrived. That wasn't my case. What happened to me was the great relief of bondage of self. I really lost all that fear, all that anxiety, worry, all those things. It was a magic elixir for me. It got me out of myself from the very first time. And everything was the same, and I became a weekend warrior. I would get whacked every weekend. And it went on for a few years. I was losing interest in school, and at about 16, I couldn't deal with the verbal and physical abuse anymore. So I signed myself out of school at 16, got myself a job at 16, and I rented myself a room in this little Spanish household for $60 a week. And I was on my own, and still I couldn't shake that great release from alcohol. From a weekend warrior, I became a midweek warrior, and a total out-and-out warrior. So I was looking for direction. I wanted to join the army at 17. My mom wouldn't sign me in because the war was going on in Vietnam. And my 18th birthday, I went into service. And over there, they had a bar in the barracks. It just progressed. And I got out of the service with the skin of my teeth. And I came home. And first, I was living with my family. Then my drinking was really pretty serious. And I got asked to leave from there. Then I became at a friend's house. And I became an unwelcome guest on many friends' couches. And then, late 20s, out-and-out homelessness. I picked a pretty rough neighborhood because I was homeless in the neighborhood, and I said, you know what, I'm going to get out. So I wound up in the South Bronx, and you know what goes on up there. Some of you guys, I ran that way. So that's another part of my story that I'm not supposed to mention. Okay. So I got the 5-minute warning. It was out of control. My drinking was out of control. So a lot of times I went in and I did half measures. They told me I was in a dozen detoxes. When you get out of detox, go to a meeting. I never made it to a meeting most of them times. And it's true what they say about half measures. And on my last drink, I got beat up pretty bad at a crack spot. And in a drunken blackout, fractured my skull in 3 places, punctured my lung with a stab wound, broke my shoulder, and I wound up in a coma. And when I got wheeled out of there in a wheelchair after I got out of the coma, I said, there's 2 things I'm going to do. Get my health back as best I can. And I knew about this group, and I'm going to say, I'm get busy. So I got James as a sponsor. And I started procrastinating on step 4 and 5. And James, now, this was an ego. It really woke me up. And my ego motivated me. This is the irony of it. My ego motivated me. He said, you're a good guy and all, but if you're not going to get busy with this step 4 and 5, we're going to have to part our ways. So I got busy because my ego wouldn't let me come in there. And when I got through to 4 and 5, I realized that I had a deep, embedded resentment towards my father. And I had a big ego with a very low self-esteem. And that's what the process of the steps did for me. That was big. It's because I love the book because it outlines, it has directions, it has warnings, it has solutions, and it has some promises. The promises are a beautiful fulfillment of after you finish the process of steps. That's what comes into your life. Let me just gather my thoughts. I know I got a couple minutes left here. I learned a lot of things that right before you get into step 4. This is what blew me away. Our liquor was but a symptom. That really was an eye-opening thing. And so we had to get down to causes and conditions. And another thing I learned, I took this resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stems all forms of spiritual disease. I had a big resentment. And I imagine it was running in my family for maybe hundreds of years, and I'm grateful I could break that chain. You may laugh, but It goes on. Where I'm at now, I only have 1 minute left, and he's going to say goodbye to me in a couple minutes, is the culmination. If you do get down, if you get busy, you do the steps, they don't just materialize in your life. It's action. You take action, and then the promises start to materialize in your life. I found this one, and I want to read this to you. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. You don't get these things. They don't come to you. You got to work for it. It's a disease I don't recover from. It's a disease that I have to maintain. And I'm grateful I have them. I'm grateful that I have the desire to maintain my disease. And that's about it out of me, guys.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Andrea.
Hi, I'm Andrea. I'm an alcoholic. I have a sponsor, Amy D. I have a home group, AG. And my sobriety date is 6/12/07. So what it was like, what it's like now, and how I got here. What it was like, I'm 23, I'm young, you know, and I had a lot of fun, and it led to a lot of misery. I had a host of fair weather friends, but I was always lonely, and I always wanted the outsides to look good, and I always achieved it. But my insides, like, were killing me. I was a miserable. I was a wreck. And I started to see that there might be a different way to live my life. That I didn't have to be upset all the time. That I didn't always have to be in my head. And I started seeing people that were close to me come into the program. But to backtrack for a second, I grew up in New York City. Fast. You know. Loved it. But at the same time, I hated it, you know. I loved you if you did something that I liked, but I hated you if you did something I didn't like. I was a very black and white person, and I wouldn't change for the world. And I got to a point where I was miserable. I just hit this bottom within myself that I can't even explain. I just felt so bad all of the time, and I was in self-pity all of the time, and that's hard for me to admit because I like to believe that I can, you know, I say to my sponsor all the time, like, oh, I'll just deal with it. What that means, I don't know, and I lived my life dealing with things, and it doesn't work. It didn't work. It hasn't worked. What works are these rooms, but that's in a minute. I hit a bottom, and, like, I didn't want to admit it. I really didn't want to admit it. I didn't even know if I was really an alcoholic. You know, I'm 23. Like, aren't you supposed to go out and get blacked out drunk and, like, have crazy stories and, like, pictures piece together your nights? Like, isn't that, like, the cool thing to do? That's what I always thought. And it's apparently not. You know, it's not normal. It's not normal, but I filled my life with such people that it was normal. Like, we all called each other, like, oh, what'd we do last night? I don't know. Like, look at the pictures. Look at Facebook, you know, go for it. So that's sort of how it was going on. And all my friends, you know, were in the same boat as me. And I just became so terminally disgusted and miserable with myself that I couldn't handle it anymore. So I sought help, and I put down things, but I never put down alcohol because I was like, that's not my problem. Like, I'm not an alcoholic. I know what alcoholics are, and that's not me. You know, I can, like, maintain myself. I can handle myself. I can compose myself. I can go out. I don't drink in the morning. You know, not true. I am an alcoholic. It started with a drink, it ended with a drink. And when I take that drink, I don't know what's going to happen. You know, like, I could be fine or I could be blacked out. It doesn't matter. You know, it's like Russian roulette. You know, am I willing to play the game anymore? And it's no. You know, my life is too important to me right now. I came to a point where I said, something's got to give. And I put things down, and I just wouldn't give up alcohol. I didn't understand what the problem was. And I saw people that were in my life very close to me come into this program, and they were getting really happy. You know, they would go for oatmeal with people and come back smiling and happy. And I was like, what is going on? Like, how are you so happy to eat oatmeal? Like, I don't care how many fruit you put in your oatmeal. Like, it's not that great. Like, you shouldn't be glowing. Like, your eyes shouldn't be this bright. Like, are you under, like, did they slip something in your oatmeal? Like, I don't understand. And I just saw this light, and it's a program of attraction rather than promotion. And I just saw this light, and I saw the attraction. And so I thought I'd give it a shot. And I went to, like, a meeting a week. And, you know, I'd go hungover. You know, no big deal. But I listened, and I got what I needed to get. And when I was finally at my breaking point, I asked someone to be my sponsor, and I jumped into the steps, and I did it vigorously. What I do today is a lot of things. It's a program of action. So the first thing I do every morning is I hit my knees, you know, and I do have a hard time with that. For a newcomer, like, I call it whatever. I'm like, whatever, help me, keep me sober. Thank you, whatever you are. You know, that's what I do, and that's enough, you know. And since I've done that, since I've started to actually take the action to hit my knees in the morning, at night, sometimes even in the day, things work out okay. Even if they're not okay, like, they're okay. And so that's what I do. I pray. My way doesn't work. I pray for clarity on situations, and I generally get it. You know, God doesn't make too hard terms for those who seek him. So that's what I do. Then I call my sponsor every morning, and I do that so that I've never been accountable in my life, ever. And I'm accountable, and I try to be honest, and it's a program of honesty, and apparently I'm very dishonest and vague. So I pray to be honest and less vague and clear, and it helps. And, you know, and my sponsor is the voice of reason, you know, tells me what's going on, you know, how to break it down. And then it also allows me to get a connection with my higher power. I work the 12 steps. I'm currently on step one, but I work the 12 steps. And, you know, if I don't want to change, then I won't work the 12 steps. But I do want to change. I don't want to just be sober. I want to be in sobriety. And I have a home group, and I do that because a lone wolf does not survive on its own. You know, a lone wolf will not survive. You need to be in a pack. You know, you have to be in the middle of the pack. And I refuse to leave this now. So I have a home group, and I have two service commitments at my home group. And that's so that I'm accountable, again, you know, so I show up. People are relying on me to serve the coffee. People are relying on me to sell them CDs. You know, it's like that. Those are my commitments, and I do them. I don't question it. I just do it. I also read literature every day. Every day I start my morning or I end my night with reading literature. And that helps me to remember that there's a solution. There is a solution. It's in the book. It's right there in front of me. And all I have to do is pick up and read it. I also call three people in the program a day, with time, with not time. And that helps me get a foundation. I'm obsessed with myself, so it helps me get out of myself for however long they'll talk to me. So it's very helpful. And another thing I do is unselfish acts. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. It gets me out of myself for like a minute, and that's amazing, you know, because I'm always thinking about myself. It's sick. And so I do that. I also do three gratitudes a day, and I can't be in self-pity when I'm grateful. They don't match. It's like oil and vinegar. Like, it doesn't work. So that helps me tremendously. And also, you know, my connection with my higher power, it grows. The more work I do, the more work I do with my sponsor, the more work I do on my own, the more work I do in prayer. And as my prayer gets bigger, and as my whatever gets bigger, I can I can lead a useful life. Like, my goal is to be of maximum service. And I try day to time. Like, I'm not perfect. And I think that if I don't drink and I don't do other things, that's a miracle. You know, it is an absolute miracle. But in the same regard, if I want to change and I want to live a healthy and useful life, I have to do these steps. And I mean, I don't have to. No one's putting a gun to my head. But I want to do them. Like, I don't want to be that person anymore. I want to be the person that I was meant to be. And I want to be comfortable being me. And that's what these steps and the fellowship and sponsorship and prayer has really brought to my life. So if, you know, you're new and you don't know if you're an alcoholic, like, I was there too, you know. And I am one, you're probably one too. But, you know, just, like, stick around, enjoy the ride. You know, it's kind of fun. Even when it's bad, it's fun. You know, you can laugh at it later. And just stick with it, and that's it. Thank you.
And tonight, our main speaker is Sydney.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sydney, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello. My sobriety date is October 15th, 1985, and last week I celebrated 23 years in AA. Thank you. You'd be standing if you only knew. And, I'll start from the beginning. My mother was 12 years old, and my father 14 years old, when they were put into a concentration camp for 5 years of their life. After the war, they met, married, and my brother was born in Germany. And 10 years after that, they came to America, and I was born. The golden child. And my father's ambition and hard work made him a successful businessman, and my mother a housewife. And I was afforded all the opportunities that a young man could ever want, and the love and support and nurturing of my parents. But all those opportunities were wasted. All the wonderful choices available to me, gone. Because I can only choose one thing, alcohol. I couldn't say no. I could not say no. 13 years old to about 17 years old, we would spend summers upstate, and drinking was sort of a summer thing. I never brought it home. During the school year, and there was some unmanageability there. But I learned that the discomfort, the fear, the restlessness, irritable, discontent feelings that I had with life were assuaged by those summer drinks. I really crossed that invisible line when I was 18 years old and I went away to college. And there, the controls were off, and I began drinking nightly. At the time, I had a girlfriend, and she drank the way I did, and I literally took my alarm clock and threw it in the garbage pail and drank every single night. And I was clueless how everyone else was functioning and doing what they did at school. And I really didn't know why I was there. I knew I wanted something bigger, better, more grandiose. You know, I was that egocentric with the inferiority complex, big daydreamer. And this went on for a while. And then the year 1977, I'm 19 years old, and the famous Studio 54 opens. And I go, and I go, and I never leave. I never leave. And I really mean this. I left college to go to Studio 54. And that was my choice, another wonderful choice. And I couldn't believe it. 19 years old and all the fame and fortune in there. And those were the things that I wanted. Those were that was my value system. I just wanted out of wherever my feet were. I wanted something bigger, better. And I spent those nights just drinking and dreaming, drinking and dreaming. And nothing happened. I think that the unmanageability was disguised by youth. And lo and behold, I then decided that I would attend acting school, and I convinced my parents that I needed to leave college and that, you know, send me to acting school. And it was very difficult going to classes while going to Studio 54. And so I conveniently made all my classes in the afternoon so I can sleep it off. And I really never attended, you know, classes. I mean, while all my peers were stomping the pavement as they, you know, I was stomping the dance floor. And so time went on, and I went on a holiday to Florida. And there, one evening, I was drunk enough to fall in love. And and I was not out of the closet yet, and this was my first experience. And he lived in San Francisco, and so even though I had just left college, and even though I had just enrolled in acting school, and even though I was just getting some extra work on this soap opera, and these little things were happening, I decided that it would be a good decision to move to San Francisco. And so I did, because I spent a drunken week in Florida, and I returned to my parents' dismay and shipped off to San Francisco. And here, I don't know how it happened, but it was alcohol. And slowly, you know, I packed a bag full of gorgeous sweaters and, you know, sport coats and stuff like that, and I can tell you that I don't know what happened to those clothes. You know, I don't know what happened to me, but suddenly, through daily drinking, my life in a short time at 20 years old became very dark and ominous, and the people that I hung around were dangerous, and I began to lose a lot of weight and become sickly because of my drinking. I had come out of the closet through a letter to my parents and were convinced that they disowned me, and I was despondent and distraught. And I was one time walking down the street, and I was 20 years old, and someone came over to me and handed me a dollar. You know, I just can't imagine what I looked like. And, you know, it was really, really horrible. I was living a life, you know, on the edge, the fringe, the underbelly of San Francisco, and it was very, very dangerous. And I found myself on Salvation Army lines for food, unwilling to work, incapable of working. I had a moment of clarity after a year. And, during that stint, in the middle, on a blackout, I called my parents and told them I'm returning home. And they were so happy. And I came home and came out of the blackout and said, I made a mistake and went back. And, you know, my poor parents. And, anyway, after a year there, I had a moment of clarity, and I knew that if I stayed there, that I would probably die. It was just too dangerous, and so I came home. And the problem was is that when I entered my parents' home, I had tasted the forbidden fruit of excess in San Francisco, and I just couldn't cope in my parents' home. You know, I mean, I had all this, what I thought was freedom, you know, the freedom to drink the way I drank and to live by night and sleep away the day, and I could not do that in my parents' home. And so they, being great enablers, and me, being an alcoholic manipulator, convinced them to get me my own apartment, and they did. And I, under one condition, that I work for a friend of my father's. And so I was put into my own apartment, and I was 21 years old, working for a friend of my father's, and of course going to the nightclubs at night, and incapable of getting up and going to work. And the shame and the humility of that, and just confusion of, you know, this is just ridiculous. I can't do this. I can't work at this 9-to-5 thing. I'm bigger, better. Something has to happen. And my parents would just not have it. And they took me out of that apartment, and I returned home. But on my 22nd birthday, after lashing out at my friends for not drinking the way I wanted to drink, I went to a discotheque, and there across the bar was a distinguished older gentleman quite handsome, and I sent him a drink, and we went home that evening, and I never left. And this was to change my life. He was wealthy. He was connected to famous celebrities. He had a beach home. He traveled the world, and I had arrived. This was it. I didn't need my parents' studio apartment anymore. And this was the life. This is what I was cut out to be. And clearly, through all his celebrity connections and famous people, I was going to rise to stardom like you would not believe. And what I did, though, was all those opportunities that he availed to me, I couldn't make it. I couldn't make the audition to the famous director's office, a lifetime opportunity, because I was in the nightclub, looking at my watch, drinking, and just wondering, how am I going to get up in the morning to do this? I just can't. And I chose not to go. It was endless like that. And, you know, the grandiosity of this part, please forgive me for it, but it was what I chased. It was what my value system was. And I was so young, and I believed that that would fill me up, you know, and it just didn't, you know. And I traveled the world with him, and Bob likes to hear, he always loves when I say, I've had a drink thrown in my face in every country in the world, you know, and I've thrown drinks in people's faces around the world. And and all throughout this, being young and experiencing what I believe to be this incredible lifestyle, there was a emptiness and a sadness and a soul sickness that was so deep, you know? And all I could do, everyone I knew around me was thriving. They were becoming doctors, lawyers, contractors, getting married, finishing school, grad school, and all I was doing was putting on clothes, walking up Madison Avenue, stopping for drinks in the afternoon, falling asleep, getting up in the evening, and going out and doing it again. I slept away the days and lived by night. And there was this incredible inertia, you know, and such sadness and shame and humility for my lifestyle. And by the way, my parents were thrilled. He was slightly older than they were. And so it was a very uncomfortable situation. anyway, the jig was up. He was getting on my case, and my parents were getting on my case for, you know, my bills were unmanageable. I was the big shot in the bar, you know, spending money on credit cards that I didn't have money for. He would bail me out. My parents would bail me out. You know, big shotism. Drinks for everyone. And, you know, now my body, I had alcoholic neuralgia, you know, I would vomit all the time, I was just bloated, and just spiritually bankrupt. And I started working for my father, and of course that was like a charity case, because I never was able to show up there either. And you know, day in, day out, I would have to make a phone call that I'm too sick to come in, too sick to come in. And one evening, work was out of the city, and I would drive in blackouts or having been up for 24 hours, 36 hours. It is a miracle that I didn't kill myself or other people, you know. And one night, coming home from work, I decided to go into one of my bars, and I was only going to have one drink, you know? And that one drink turned into two drinks. Two into four, four into six, six into I don't know how many. And that evening, my biggest never was to occur. And a stranger came over to me, and I went home with him. And that evening, I was drunk enough to put a needle to my arm many, many times. And it was 6 o'clock in the morning, and as I left his apartment and I'm walking through Central Park, terrified that I might be killed, and looking at my arms and hungover and knowing that I'm going to have to call my brother for the millionth time and tell him that I cannot come to work. And I was just thinking, you know, what is happening now? And how did this occur? I mean, it was only, you know, one drink that I was going to stop in for. And I came home, and my partner was just freaked out. And, you know, where were you? And what's going on? This has got to stop. I'm going to call your parents. And I ran out of excuses, and though now I realize it was the grace of God, but I didn't believe it. I just said, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. And I called my brother, and I ran out of excuses, and that was such a great one. I mean, I've used everything, you know? And in 1985, it was becoming very trendy, you know? And so I called my brother and I said, Jack, I can't come into work today. I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, he said, you know, listen, it's okay. We're going to help. We're going to help. And I had gotten a number that morning off the television, one of those 1-800 numbers, and they sent me to a place on 60th and York, Regent Hospital. And that morning I walked in there, and the doctor met with me, and he looked at my arms, and he smelled my breath, and he said, sir, you know, we will check you in right away. And I said, no, it's not what you think. And he just was amazed that I was resistant, and I said, no one has sent me here. I came here on my own, you know? And so what began was intensive therapy. 2 times a week with a group, 1 day a week with him individually. And they told me and taught me and talked about alcohol. And I talked about myself. And and they talked, and I talked. And they, in the group, were all AAers. And they kept on telling me, you know, you have to go to AA. And, you know, and I would listen. Clearly, I've sat with them for months, and, you know, they needed AA. I did not need AA. And I was doing well, except at the end of each month, for some reason, the urge to go out to a nightclub came, but I had the strength of the rehab with me, and so I would go. And there I would be, and I'd have my soda, and then I would have a drink, and then I'd have another drink, and I'd have another drink, and another drink, and another drink. And I would come back to the rehab outpatient facility with my tail between my legs, and they told me, you must go to AA. And finally, they were going to throw me out of group if I did not go to an AA meeting. And so on October 15th, 1985, I went to my first AA meeting, and the reason it's the 15th was in 1985, Columbus Day fell on the 14th, and I was not going to give up that weekend, long weekend of drinking, which I liked. And so I walked in to my first AA meeting, and it was the most amazing thing that ever happened to me. It stopped. It just stopped. And I took a breath, and a man who clearly read into action and working with others approached me, and in a gentle way put out his responsible hand and gave me his phone number and took mine and called me. And he called me the next day, you know, and he gently told me that I needed to stay away from people, places, and things, and that this urge that I had, he talked about a higher power, and he told me with blind faith that I should just get on my knees and ask for a daily reprieve from alcohol, pray to God for the obsession and the compulsion to lift. Within these 90 days, a miraculous thing happened. I mean, having been in the nightclubs and living this crazy, fast-paced life, suddenly the most substantive thing in my life became church basements and diners and Saturday evenings in someone's house playing charades, you know, or talking about program stuff and telling our stories. And it was the most fulfilling experience that I have ever had. And I quickly got involved in service, and I began the step work. And I would say that the most important thing that has occurred in my life has been the steps and finding God and having the willingness to change and the openness and the honesty to continue with the work of AA. You know, in the last 23 years, the most amazing things have occurred in my life. I have gone through many ups and downs, life on life terms. Went back to college in sobriety, and I got my degree. I thought I wanted to be a social worker, and then after re-educating myself, I decided I didn't want to be a social worker. And, you know, that's good. That's okay. You know, but I got that. I went back and got that BA. I opened two businesses in sobriety. That is a miracle that someone like me was capable of doing that. And that's because I'm sober and I have the steps behind me and the support of AA. I fell in love in AA, and I've lost love in AA. I've buried the four most important people in my life while sober, and I was responsible and available to them. I held those people in my arms while they died. What a privilege. You know, years and years before that, when my mother had quadruple heart bypass surgery, what an effort it was to show up, you know, and be there when that clock was ticking and I knew that my nightlife was going to start soon and that this infringement of visiting my mother ill, you know, though I loved her a lot, but it was just in the way of that drink. Or when my best friend's father died and I had to go and do a Shiva call, I couldn't do it because I had an important evening drinking engagement. That was the type of person I was when I was drinking. Funerals? Please, who can get up that early? You know? And this was different, you know? And quite an experience being responsible. The most rewarding things in my life today are having sponsees and working with them and the newcomer and taking them through the steps. I continue to learn so much from that. I also want to say, as the years went on, I found myself once again acting out, angry, resentful, fearful. My life was unmanageable, and yet I wasn't drinking. And I mean, had I come this far to feel this way? I mean, what was wrong? What was wrong now? I mean, I had done the steps. I did them. Well, that was just it. I did them. I wasn't living them anymore. And through some big book study meetings and some new people that entered my life, I realized that I, as they say in Into Action, I was resting on my laurels. And what I did was realize that the 10th step continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Like a daily reflection said a while ago, rarely, occasionally, frequently, well, that's what I was doing. No, continued, every day, every day. And the 11th step, every day, prayer and meditation, and working with newcomers. Working with newcomers, the 12th step, every day. And that's what I began to do. And my life turned around again. And I want to just leave the message that now, at 50 years old, I came in here when I was 27, I'm faced with life on life terms again. Lots of challenges, some transition, but the promises are true in my life today, even with the challenges that I have. And it is just amazing that by practicing these principles in all of my affair and living in step 10 and 11 and 12, that I walk through this gracefully, that prayer and my higher power and my conscious contact with him continues to just get me by. And I want you all to know that all of you are a mirror of who I am, and I see courage, faith, love, strength, compassion, survivors in all of you and in me. And I really appreciate all of you being here and being a part of what keeps me whole today. So thank you.